William Burroughs never won the Nobel Prize for Literature, but his novel Naked Lunch became a landmark in 20th century American literature. It was also the subject of the last obscenity trial in the U.S. involving a novel. That was back in 1965. For the next 3 days, three universities in New York will be celebrating the novel's 50th anniversary, as Tom Vitale reports.
Naked Lunch is a dark and wild ride, filled with paranoia, elation, horror, erotic fantasies, opium dreams, and hallucinations. Author William S. Burroughs extrapolates the terror of heroin withdrawal into a vivid scene of horrible creatures drinking in a dark cafe.
Thin, purple-blue lips cover a razor-sharp beak of black bone, with which they frequently tear each other to shreds in fights over clients.
Burroughs read from the novel for a 1990 commercial recording. 5 years earlier, sitting in the apartment he called the bunker, in the locker room of a closed YMCA on the Bowery, Burroughs said the novel was autobiographical.
It's just my character. I was always attracted to that sort of thing. Some people like neat suburbs. I always am attracted to the rundown or the old or the offbeat.
Burroughs had the money to indulge his eccentricities. He was an heir to the Burroughs Adding Machine Company. He studied medicine at Harvard. He was also an original member of the Beat Literary Circle that included novelist Jack Kerouac and poet Allen Ginsberg. Burroughs said his work had little in common stylistically with those two, but their encouragement had everything to do with his becoming a writer.
But remember, none of us had ever published anything. We couldn't call ourselves writers. And I sort of resisted the idea of being a writer. But Jack definitely did encourage me, and he said that I would write a novel called, and the title would be Naked Lunch. That's his title, Kerouac.
Burroughs said the Naked Lunch is a frozen moment when everyone sees what's at the end of every fork. The novel offered a stark contrast to the prevailing vision of reality when it was published, says poet Ann Waldman.
It's post-World War II, and it's not the woman with her Kelvinator refrigerator opening the door to show you how crisp the lettuce stays. It's, you know, a moment frozen on the end of that fork where you see reality clearly. So you see the lettuce decomposing.
The shocking reality of Naked Lunch caused a furor when excerpts were published in the University of Chicago's literary magazine in 1958. A Paris pornographer took note and published Naked Lunch in France the following year. Then in 1962, Grove Press issued the first American edition. A year later, a Boston bookstore owner was arrested for selling it. At the obscenity trial, the book was defended by writers Norman Mailer, Allen Ginsberg, and John Ciardi. Finally, in 1966, a high court ruled that the book had redeeming social value and was therefore not obscene. One of the themes of Naked Lunch is restrictions on freedom. A recurring character in the novel is the sinister and prescient Dr. Benway, an expert in interrogation, brainwashing, and control.
As regards the interrogation of suspects, Benway has this to say. While in general I avoid the use of torture, torture localizes the opponent and mobilizes resistance. The threat of torture is useful to induce in the subject the appropriate feeling of helplessness and gratitude to the interrogator for withholding it.
What Naked Lunch is a vision of the truth.
Regina Weinreich teaches Beat Generation Literature at New York's School of Visual Arts.
It cuts through the norms of society, the way that we all have to be polite, the way we all have to follow our institutions, our governments, our addictions, perhaps even to power and to language, and offers us an alternative. And the alternative is to be individual and to go to those places on our own.
To date, Naked Lunch has sold more than 1 million copies. Author William S. Burroughs was elected to the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters in 1975. He died in 1997 at the age of 83.
The dream police disintegrate in globs of rotten ectoplasm, swept away by an old junkie, coughing and spitting in the sick morning.
For NPR News, I'm Tom Vitale in New York.
We we want to go back to October of 2002. Even if you did not live in the Washington, D.C. area, you probably remember those awful 3 weeks when 10 people were shot to death and 3 more were seriously wounded. The violence seemed to come out of nowhere, the victims apparently chosen at random, regular people going about their daily lives, including a 13-year-old boy who was going to school. Who would do such a thing? His name, it turned out, was John Allen Muhammad. Aided by a young accomplice named Lee Boyd Malvo, Muhammad became known as the Beltway Sniper, and he inspired deep and widespread terror. John Muhammad is scheduled to be executed next month. But before John Muhammad terrorized the nation's capital, he had already terrorized one woman, his former wife, Mildred Muhammad. And after years of silence, she has written a new book, Scared Silent, where she talks about how she met him, the years of abuse she endured in their relationship, and how she found out that he was behind the killing spree. An excerpt of the book was published in this Sunday's Washington Post magazine. Mildred Muhammad joins me now from her office in Camp Springs, Maryland. This is her first national broadcast interview. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate this opportunity.
I was thinking about what a big deal it is to step out after all these years of living in fear, really. I mean, you were in protective custody at one point because you and the authorities believed that if John Muhammad knew where you were, he would kill you. So what made you want to speak publicly and now?
Well, it was my desire to assist other victims and survivors of domestic violence. Because this was a domestic violence issue, I did not have the physical scars to prove that I was a victim of domestic violence. It is because I did not have the physical scars that my help was slow in coming.
Why do you say this is a domestic violence situation?
Because in the beginning, in July of 1999, John and I were experiencing separation. And at that point, I asked him to leave. However, he still had keys to the house, and he was coming in the middle of the night standing over me. At one point, he told me that you have become my enemy, and as my enemy, I will kill you. He was also in the community, so a lot of people knew him as a go-to person. If you needed something from John, then you could go to him, and he would definitely get it for you. He was a man of his word. He said what he meant, and he meant what he said. So when I tried to get help from those same individuals, they looked up on me as if I was the one that was crazy, or what did I do to him to cause him to behave in this manner. It came to the point where I had to get a restraining order on him, and then we set up arrangements for him to see the children. This particular weekend, he was supposed to have them back at a certain time. He did not. My son told me that the night he was supposed to bring them back, he boarded a plane to Antigua, and it would be 18 months before I saw my children again.
You had to have the intervention of the authorities, is that right? To
well, the authorities said that because we didn't have a parenting plan in place, that he had a right to the children as well as I.
How did you finally get the children back?
It was August the 30th, 2001. The executive director of the shelter that I was living in called and stated that they may have found my children and I needed to fax all of the paperwork to the Whatcom County Police Department in Bellingham, Washington, which I did. At that point, it was a detective that stated that they found my children and that I needed to fly back to Tacoma to an emergency custody hearing. While at the hearing, the judge stated that the children would be placed back with me. When we went outside to call CPS, Child Protective Services, I felt a presence behind me, which was John, charging at me. I ran down the hallway, as did my attorney and the friend who was with us. He approached the doorway of the courtroom, looked at me and said, "Gotcha." My attorney was afraid for our lives at that point and said, "We need to hurry up and get the children so that you can leave tonight, going back to Maryland."
And I think why all this relates to the issue that a lot of people know about, which is that John's later transformation into this killer, is that it's your view that in part the shooting spree was aimed at you, that he was looking for you. He was trying to harm you in a way to in order to recover his children. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. He went from Tacoma all the way over to the East Coast where I lived. I believe that I was the intended target, and if the random shootings was to cover up my murder so that he can come in as the grieving father to regain custody of the children.
Let's back up again, if we can, and just tell us a little bit about him and how. What was he like when you first met him?
He was a man of his word. He said he was going to do something. He did it. If he was not able to, then he had the courage to come to you to say, you know, I'm not able to do this. Perhaps we can do this another way, or I can do it at another time. And that's what most people liked about him.
You're saying that the early years of your marriage were good ones.
Yes, ma'am. The early years of our marriage was good.
And when did he start to change?
Once he got back from Saudi Arabia.
Why was he in Saudi Arabia?
He was in the Army, 84th Engineers. When he came back, he was a totally different person. The man that left was jovial, the life of the party, was not afraid to express his feelings or to go out of his way to help you. When he came back, he was very reserved. He sat in the corner, pondering what happened to him in Saudi. I don't believe that I will ever know exactly what happened to him there. But whatever it was, it shook his foundation and changed him completely from the person that I knew before he left.
And he never told you anything about his time there, his service, or anything that would have given you anything to grab onto about what was motivating this change in behavior to you?
Well, he stated that there was a situation where soldiers were not being treated fairly based upon race. There was a smoke grenade that was thrown into the tent. And the officials in their investigation decided that John was trying to commit suicide. So they took him from his unit. They hogtied him and put him in a dungeon-like place with his head to the floor and left him there. And he said, do you know what they were trying to do? They were trying to kill me. Why would anybody want to do that? All I wanted to do was to be a good soldier. That is what changed him.
I was going to ask you that when he came back, though, I wanted to ask, what was it that caused you to feel eventually that you had to leave the relationship? What happened?
He said, you have become my enemy, and as my enemy, I will kill you. I didn't feel I needed to wait around for that to happen.
You tell a story in the book about how he would play board games with the children, but became a thing where he had to win. So
yes,
he would do anything to win, including cheat or change the rules, and to the point where the children didn't want to be with him, and then he would hold that against you. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, he would teach them how to play the games correctly, and then he would change the rules on it so that they would always lose. My son became aware of how he was doing that and just stopped playing with him altogether. My son also told him on one occasion that, you know, you're only concerned, he was 7 years old at the time, you're only concerned with situations that concern you. You don't want to play with me the way I want to play. It's got to be your way or no way, and I don't want to play with you anymore. So my son was very in tune to how his father was treating him, and he no longer wanted to play with him.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Mildred Muhammad. She's written a new book, Scared Silent. It tells the story of her years with John Muhammad, the Beltway sniper, her years as his wife, and how she found out that he was the center of law enforcement attention for the attacks in the Beltway. Just to bring us up to date, at the time that these attacks took place, you had just moved to the Washington area not too long before. Do you remember when you saw the news about what was happening, how you reacted before you realized that he was involved?
Well, I think it was in October when there was that cluster of people being killed on the same day, which got everybody's attention. And so I was fearful and scared, trying to understand what was going on, just like everybody else. Did I think it was John? No.
How did you find out that he was a person of interest?
I think it was October the 23rd, ATF knocked on my door. They asked me to come down to the police station to answer questions. And as I was there, an FBI agent continuously walked in and out of the room. And once he walked back in, he stated, Ms. Muhammad, we're just going to have to tell you, we're going to name your ex-husband as the sniper.
What went through your mind?
Total disbelief and horror. Then they asked me, do you think he would do something like this? And I looked up at the ceiling and I was like, well, yeah. And they said, well, why would you think that? I said, we were watching a movie. I don't remember the name of it. And he said, I could take a small city, terrorize it. They would think it would be a group of people, and it would only be me. And I said, why would you do something like that? And he changed the subject. Then that's when the police asked me, did I want to go into protective custody? And they said, well, Ms. Muhammad, didn't you know he was shooting people around you? I said, well, how would I know that if I'm in hiding? They said, well, the man that he shot in the hand with the laptop, that's right down the street from you. The gentleman that was shot at the store in Brandywine, that's 2 miles away from you. You were the target. Didn't you know you were the target? And at that point, they told me that we were going to be placed in police custody and we needed to go and get my children and my sister and brother-in-law.
I'm sure most people can't even imagine what that was like.
That was, it's one thing for someone to say they're going to kill you, but then to actually see the work that was put into trying to disguise it, I still have not completely wrapped my brain around that fact. We were married for 12 years. We have 3 children together. I don't understand why he hated me so much to the point of where he wanted to kill me. And it would have been one shot right in the head, and that was it. Because he was one shot, one kill. He was registered as an expert in the military.
But he was an expert marksman.
He was an expert marksman, yes, ma'am.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Mildred Muhammad. She's the former wife of the Beltway sniper. She's written a new book about their relationship and her understanding of Muhammad's behavior. Please stay with us on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a moment, the Supreme Court session began yesterday. We'll talk about what's in front of the court in a few minutes. But first, we're going to continue our conversation with Mildred Muhammad. She is the ex-wife of John Allen Muhammad, the infamous Beltway sniper who terrorized the Washington, D.C. area in October of 2002. He and a young accomplice killed 10 people during a 3-week period and wounded 3 others. John Muhammad is scheduled to be executed next month. His ex-wife is now speaking out about the man she was married to for 12 years. She says he was changed by serving in the military during the Gulf War. Mildred Muhammad, before the break, you told us that you were the ultimate target of the attacks. But I wonder, what was it like when you found out that he'd been apprehended?
My attention went completely on my children. I don't believe I thought about myself at that particular point, because my children were crying. They were trying to understand. It wasn't until I was able to put them to sleep that I went into the bathroom with a pillow, turned on the water, and sat on the floor and cried, trying to understand what was all of this about and why would he want to kill me and take innocent people along the way. I blamed myself. For that, because I thought maybe I didn't yell loud enough. Maybe I didn't tell enough people. Why didn't they listen to me? That was the one thing I continuously said over and over and over. Why didn't they listen to me? Why didn't they listen to me?
Listen to what? What would you have wanted them to hear?
To understand that John was a dangerous man. Did I know he was going to come up with a plot like this? No. But he was trying to kill me. And perhaps if somebody would have listened to me, then he would have been off the street and would not have exploded in the manner in which he did.
Can I ask you this question?
Mm-hmm.
I take your point completely, and nobody has walked in your shoes. Trust me when I say I don't judge you in any way. But I wonder why you're so sure he was trying to kill you and that he just didn't like... I guess what I'm asking you is it possible he just liked the attention, that it made him feel like a big shot?
No. So you don't know John. And that's why I don't look at it as someone judging me. I just look at it that you don't know John. The people that know John know that this is something he could do. So because you're not able to understand or comprehend the level of planning that John does, John would, when he was in the military, he would measure the dew on the grass when the sun is coming up to find out how fast it would dry. He had to be detailed in everything he did. He had a plan A, B, and C, and an outlined 1, 2, and 3 on each. He had a backup to the backup to the backup. Whatever he put in motion had to succeed.
And I realize, and I take your point that it's not fair to ask you to get inside his head, but what do you think his endgame scenario was?
His endgame scenario was to come in as the grieving father, to get the compensation, the victim's compensation, because John and I were divorced October the 6th of 2000, so my children would have been considered victims of crime. And they would have received the victim's compensation, and he would have drove away. Nobody would have been the wiser. He maybe would have been called the father of the year for coming in as the grieving father.
How are the children now?
They're doing good. My son is in college and my daughters are in performing arts school. My son is 19 and my daughters are 16 and 17. No, they do not talk to him. No, they do not have a relationship with him.
But you mentioned earlier that you still felt, and I wonder if you still feel this, maybe this was just an initial reaction, you felt guilty. You felt in a way that perhaps you had done more to call attention to him.
That was my initial reaction.
How about now?
Now I know that I did all that I was supposed to do and all that I could do, and I have to let the rest of it go.
What would you like people to draw from your story?
I would like for them to know that you don't have to have physical scars to be a victim or a survivor of domestic violence. There's a comprehensive safety plan in the back of the book, along with resources to assist those who may find themselves in a situation like mine or similar to get the help that they need and not to go through the pitfalls that I went through in order to get the help that I needed to be free of that abuse.
What do you think might have made a difference for you?
I believe what would have made a difference for me is when John came back from Saudi, that he would have been debriefed and he would have received the counseling that he needed to be a more productive person in a non-war zone. That's what I believe.
How are you doing, by the way? I understand through the book that you have remarried.
I have, August the 4th of 2007. And he is a wonderful man. His name is Reuben Muhammad, and my children love him, and so do I, and he loves us too. And he has 5 children as well, so we are one big happy family.
Well, that's a wonderful outcome to what a difficult period of years. You sound happy.
I am, and I've also started an organization called After the Trauma that assists survivors of domestic violence because I feel like I had to do something to help the women who may find themselves in a position where they can't get back on their feet.
And finally, Mrs. Muhammad, forgive me, John Muhammad is currently scheduled to be executed on November 10th. His accomplice, Lee Boyd Malvo, is sentenced to life without parole. Do you have an opinion about those sentences?
No.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for speaking with us. My best wishes to your family.
Thank you.
Mildred Muhammad, her new book is called Scared Silent. An excerpt of the book appeared this weekend in the Washington Post magazine. We'll have a link on our website. Just go to npr.org. Thank you again.
Thank you.
After all the time, after you, did you see me with someone new? Hanging so high for your return. But the stillness.
Dan Shaun's novel, Among the Missing, was a finalist for the National Book Award. Book critic Maureen Corrigan can't decide whether his latest novel, Await Your Reply, should be given an award or a lie detector test.
Dan Shaun's latest novel, Await Your Reply, came out at the end of August, traditionally a stagnant period in the publishing calendar, and so a logical time to feature this work of literary fiction by a writer who has his devoted followers, but by no means is a best-selling big name. But sales considerations aside, autumn, with its mists and early nightfalls, would have been a more seasonally appropriate choice for this elegantly chilly novel about identity theft and existential confusion. Shaun's emotionally austere architectural plot demands that readers keep their wits about them. And just to make sure that his readers are alert, eyes front from the get-go, Shaun opens his novel on the scene of a teenaged boy named Ryan struggling to maintain consciousness in a car being driven by his panicked father. On the seat in between them is a styrofoam ice cooler that contains Ryan's severed hand. It's a scene straight out of a Halloween movie, but the story behind it is even more mundanely disturbing. Ryan's tale is one of three intertwined narratives that compose Await Your Reply. All of them are bleak and weird and slyly compelling. Ryan, we learn, has been drawn into a career of credit card fraud by his father, a biological father he's only recently discovered after learning that he was adopted at birth. The second, and to my mind most intriguing story, focuses on another lost teenager, a girl named Lucy, who's just graduated from high school and has left her Ohio town in the middle of the night with her former history teacher, a charismatic guy named George Orson. They hole up for weeks at a long-shuttered motel complex in Nebraska that George claims was owned by his family. Think the landscape of Psycho, because that's what Shaun invites us readers to think. Shaun also winks throughout this heavily elusive novel to the work of other cultured creepmeisters like Joyce Carol Oates, Mary Shelley, Edgar Allan Poe, and H.P. Lovecraft. In the third tale of this unholy trinity, a man named Miles has been searching for a decade for his twin brother Hayden, who suffers, perhaps, from schizophrenia. Miles believes he's finally closing in on his demonic double at an abandoned scientific research station in the Arctic. Throughout the novel, Shaun keeps transporting us to fantastic landscapes like that one. Some are all too real, like Las Vegas. Others could be. Near that deserted motel where Lucy and George are hiding, for instance, is a sprawling, dried-up reservoir, which was originally created by flooding a town, Nebraska's own version of Atlantis. It seems that neither places, nor stories, nor human identities are stable in this spinning nebula of a novel. As you might expect with a writer who toys so obsessively with the idea of the self as free-floating rather than fixed, old-fashioned character development is not a major concern here. Indeed, in the course of Await Your Reply, a reader learns the hard way not to get attached to any of these characters, since, to varying degrees, they show themselves to be not quite who we, or sometimes they, first think they are. Intelligence is the draw here, demonstrated by the seemingly infinite number of riffs the novel can generate on the theme of multiple identities. In a reflective and unintentionally funny moment, Jay, Ryan's credit card thief dad, explains to him the more philosophical attractions of stealing other people's identities. I can't understand how people can settle for having just one life, Jay says. I remember we were in English class and we were talking about that poem by that one guy, David Frost, Two Roads Diverged in a Yellow Wood. You know this poem, right? I love that poem, but I remember thinking to myself, why? How come you can't travel both roads? That seemed really unfair to me. Shaun cements his smarts in the novel's final pages with an ending that clicks shut like a coffin lid. You won't be saddened by that ending, but unless you're made of tougher stuff than I am, you will be startled.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Await Your Reply by Dan Shaun.